Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. Great performances begin with a comfortable close shave from Gillette. Gillette, making men's lives just that little bit easier.
Game on 2FM.
Weekdays from 7.
And a very good evening from Damien O'Mara. You're very welcome to the Thursday edition of Game On. Golf, rugby, soccer, racing and US sport to come this side of 8 o'clock. Shortly, we will hear from Rory McIlroy on the day he confirms that he's to opt out of the Irish Open in order to better prepare for the Open Championship at Royal Portrush. We're going to hear as well from the Republic of Ireland manager Colin Bell as the draw takes place for the Women's World Cup qualifiers, European Championship qualifiers, I should say. We have the jockey and one of the stars of a great new documentary series about Irish female jockeys to come, and we're going to chat stateside sport with Shep as well. And in addition to that, look ahead to the rugby weekend. England and Wales, is it really going to be a championship decider? And if you want to have an insight into kind of mind games and using the media for messages, wait till you hear some of what Eddie Jones and Warren Gatland have come up with today. 51552 is our text number. At GameOn2FM will get us on Twitter. You can email the program gameon@rte.ie or make contact through the RTE Radio Player app. And keeping me on the straight and narrow between now and the end of the program is Bernard Jackman and Gary Murphy. Gentlemen, good evening to you both.
Good evening. Evening.
I was just thinking there, the story in the news about the drone at Dublin Airport, which obviously that type of behaviour we would condemn and there's no place for it, but like, Bielsa, if he just got a drone at Christmas, none of this Leeds United stuff would have been an issue. And like, you know,
200 grand would have been saved.
Yeah, there was a story today that the British Horse Racing Authority in Cheltenham, that, you know, they're going to monitor drone usage around the track, because if you wanted to, and if you were of that persuasion, you could be watching footage through a drone in advance of it being on television by the delay that's in place, and it might manipulate betting markets and everything else. But if you bought a good drone, you could easily, say in a rugby context, fly it over a training ground and have the insight into another team's preparations, if you were that mean about things, Bernard.
Yeah, you probably could, but I think they're obviously they'd see that drone and wonder who was flying it, and you wouldn't get away with it for long.
Josh Smith with a
shotgun, shotgun, and take it down. Listen, I think there's more and more people trying to find different ways of, you know, either espionage or disrupting events, and it's you know, the fact what they've been able to do to shut down Gatwick, you know, whatever it was 2 months ago, was incredible.
But it is, like, it's gone.
It's amazing the damage that it can do to an aircraft because of the tests on it. It can blow a huge hole in the plane, like, it's, which is surprising, really. But
I suppose there's not really a benefit in golf to spying on your opponent, really, is there?
No. Spying on your own brain is the only that's what you'd use the drone
might be a good
for.
Way of helping you not lose balls.
Well, maybe, yeah. Yeah, you've only 3 minutes to find it now.
Yeah, okay, there we go.
I'd probably lose the drone normally. Yeah.
We've an awful lot to get stuck into. Rory McIlroy to come in just a moment.
Yeah. 200 after five.
He's going well. If only he could bring that form to the Irish Open, but we will chat about that in a second. England-Wales this weekend. We'll chat about it later in the programme. We're going to hear the two greatest architects of mind games, Warren Gatland and Eddie Jones. Is it a championship decider, or only a championship decider if England win?
No, I think if Wales can win, we'd obviously fancy our chances of being in the hunt on the last day. But obviously, I think England can put it to bed. I don't see England losing to Scotland and Twickenham. And I think they've Italy last round. So yeah, it's a huge game for us in terms of, you know, are we going to have anything to play for, you know, the last round. But it's also really interesting to see if Wales can find any weaknesses in England. The first two games, they've looked impeccable, and that's going to, you know, this is the biggest test for them so far. Obviously, having come to Ireland and conquered Ireland and Dublin, if they can go to the Principality and beat Wales, then they're massive contenders for not just the Six Nations, for the World Cup.
Europa League football underway. Arsenal 2-0 up, 53 minutes played at the Emirates. They lead Bade Borisov by 2-1 on aggregate. Valencia and Celtic is scoreless at the same point. That game taking place in Spain. Celtic trail 2-0 on aggregate, so it looks like their race could well and truly be run there. Chelsea take a 2-1 advantage into the home leg of their game against Malmo. Hudson-Odoi starts for Chelsea this evening, which a lot of people will have called for that for quite some time. Sarri, it's a miracle in many ways that he has survived in the job this long in light of the two results, particularly of recent weekends.
He's only been in it 6 months, so that's
But by Chelsea standards, that's too bad.
I just think it's crazy. I really do. I mean, he's moved country, moved league, totally different game. Now, I can understand Chelsea fans, the whole Kante thing, playing him out of position, it just doesn't work. He's won two leagues with different teams, he's won a World Cup playing as a holding midfielder. But it's just too fickle. You know, it's the cost of getting rid of him, and then who do you bring in? Give the guy, you know, just let them work. I think they should let them work their contracts and judge them at the end of it. But the capacity for Chelsea players to down tools is phenomenal.
But you could say that about every club. You could say
that.
Like,
they're worse, though. They're worse.
Do you think so?
Well, they finished eighth and win the league and finish eighth. You know, you can't. They're very fickle players. They really are.
But that's, you could say that about any club in the Premier League at this stage, couldn't you?
No, well, we haven't won for 29 years.
And how many managers have Liverpool gone through since then?
Not a lot. They've probably had, what have they had, four or five managers in that time?
Hodgson. So you go in reverse order. Klopp, Rodgers, Hodgson. Now this is where we get interesting. Dalglish. Houllier and Evans. Soonis.
Benitez,
which is forgot Rafa.
Missed him. He was further up, wasn't
Rafa.
He?
Yeah, the man Rafa. Who led us to a Champions League and finished second in the Premier League.
But I'd like to see the window go in January, and I'd like to see a lot more managers getting time to be on a training ground and trying to implement policy and coach players, not just come in on a whim and out you go again. It doesn't help. It doesn't help the psyche of the player, doesn't help the continuity of the club at all. And is the bubble going to burst? Well, if you keep replacing managers at 20 odd million a pop, it certainly will. And he's like, Abramovich is not even allowed into the country at the moment.
I think the problem is, because players know how vulnerable managers are, agents and players who are discontent, who are unhappy, can actually create that environment where the sacking is inevitable. Yeah. That's the challenge. You know, where the manager is right or wrong, you challenge a senior player or, you know, someone who's got influence in the dressing room, they can actually have you out the door, you know, by leaking stuff to the media. And you see a little bit in the rugby perspective, a little bit what's happened in French rugby in the last couple of weeks, where, you know, really embarrassing stories that should have probably been kept in house have been leaked on purpose, and it undermines Jack Brunel. But that happens in soccer every day of the week, and you know, it's the players who have total control. And unless you've got a really strong leadership group or really professional players, that's very dangerous.
We're going to get stuck into the golf. Rory McIlroy now 3 under after 6 holes. He's tied for the lead at the WGC event in Mexico. This comes against the backdrop of what, let's be very honest, wasn't a great surprise, but this morning confirming in an interview with BBC Northern Ireland that he will not play at the Dubai Duty Free Irish Open later on this year. He's going to prefer instead to play at the Scottish Open, which takes place the following weekend, and then will use that as his preparation for the Open Championship at Portrush. He's obviously following through on comments made before Christmas, where he said he would try and avoid playing in 3 weeks, culminating in a major championship. Here's a little bit about what he's had to say about his decision to opt out of the Irish Open.
If there's ever a year where I feel like I can miss the Irish Open, it's this year. It's a perfect storm. It's the Open's at Portrush. If I were to play the Irish Open, the Open Championship would be my third event in a row. And for me personally, that's not the best way to prepare for what could be the biggest event of my life. So I want to give myself the best chance to win the Open Championship. And that's not discrediting, and that's not, you know, belittling the Irish Open in any way, but if I want to give myself the best possible chance to win the Open Championship, I want to play the week before to get tuned up on a links course, and then I want to go straight into the Open. That third week is just a little too much for me. And like, I love the Irish Open. I've supported it my whole career. The people of Ireland are still going to see me play golf because I'm going to play the Open Championship, and I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people travelling from down south to see us play. But if there's any year to miss the Irish Open, it is this one, and I just hope people will understand, because I'm not doing it for any other reason than I think it gives me the best chance to win the Open Championship.
That's Rory McIlroy chatting to the BBC. Gary, if this is his honestly held opinion that in order for him to win a major, he can't play 3 weeks in a row, and it means missing out on the Irish Open for 1 year, who are we to castigate him?
No, we're not. I mean, he totally revived the Irish Open. It wouldn't be a Rolex event only for him. The Irish Open in Killarney was subsidised by the European Tour at £1.5 million purse. It's now a $7 million purse. McIlroy saved it single-handedly. Him, and to be fair to him, his JP Fitzgerald, his caddy, had a chat with Colin McLaughlin at Dubai Duty Free, and JP also deserves a lot of credit for that. It's just disappointing for Gary Murphy, the 12, 13-year-old kid who wants to go to the Irish Open to see Rory McIlroy. That's the main reason. Even if you take the commerciality out of the whole thing, that's why it's really disappointing. But I completely understand that if he feels, and good thing when Rory opens his mouth, you can be sure that he's saying what he feels. If he thinks that's going to give him the best chance to win a Royal Portrush, that's what he needs to do. The problem is that he's now, well, the good thing is that he's going to stay as a member of the European Tour, but it's just a slant the whole time on the European Tour. It just makes the whole thing feel like they're the poor relation. He wouldn't behave like this towards the PGA Tour.
But he's not the only player who seems to have a gripe with the PGA Tour and how the PGA Tour is structuring its calendar, and I don't want to say it's kind of trying to rule with an iron fist, but the narrative around the European Tour is, lads, here's our party. If you don't want to be a part of it, we're going to punish you.
True. But the party is a lot better than the party used to be.
Is he falling victim to the fact that because of the profile he has as a European golfer, he's a guy who answers a question with a relatively honest answer, that he has probably been construed as being more vocal, a critic of the European Tour than some others because he speaks his mind?
Possibly, but he's in a position to criticise if he wants to, because he's box office. I was covering the first event in Abu Dhabi this year, and it was noticeable the fact that McIlroy wasn't there on the attendance. I mean, he is the marquee guy. Justin Rose is world number one. He's European, but McIlroy is still the biggest draw. And listen, he's a sole trader. He can go play where he wants to play. It's just the language at times seems a little bit disparaging towards the European Tour, and the European Tour being my home tour as such, I have, you know, a great affiliation for it. And I always am of the opinion, if they all stayed at home and played in Europe, it would be as strong as the PGA Tour. Mm. But they don't want to do that. America is an easier tour to play from the point of view of travel and all that goes with it, and the pension fund and all of that. But they're trying so hard in Europe to improve things, and these are just knocks that they don't need.
But the reality of life in modern golf is that success is measured by the obscenity of earnings, first and foremost, on a yearly basis. Okay, your career retrospectively is measured in majors and what you've won, but is it only natural with the culture that's developed around golf at that level that they are going to gravitate to not only where the bigger prize money is, but where also the bigger appearance fees are?
Yeah, but then if you go, if you look at what the European Tour have done, if you go to the last event, the DP World event, and you win that event, more than likely you're going to win the tour. You're going to pick up €5 million for that week's work. Now, I know it's a season's work, but it's €2.5 million first prize the week before, and €2.5 million. So they've, like, the strides that the European Tour have made are colossal. But unless you have all the top guys buying in, they can't move on again. And, you know, the PGA Tour, if I was Rory McIlroy, I'd probably base myself in the States and play the PGA Tour, because he's married to an American girl, and it all kind of makes sense. We're just a little bit selfish in wanting to have our cake and eat it and have him here too.
And he spoke today as well about the fact that his parents spend the vast amount of the year in Florida at this stage. A lot of his family are spending an increased amount of time in America. Yeah, that his life is increasingly in America.
They spent time in Dubai when he was out playing in Dubai too. I mean, mum and dad are going to go where Rory is.
Yeah, well, I think the point he was making was they now have homes in Florida, which is, anyway, that's...
There'll probably be a few people from the NOLA beside him in the next couple of weeks.
A gated community. He spoke separately today about the fact that, you know, he is obviously going to bring an added sense of pressure on himself now amongst Irish golf fans, that he has now made this decision, and you can be damn sure people are going to be queuing up to tear the head off him on Twitter and social media on the Saturday of the Open if he suddenly finds himself well out of commission.
Yeah, but I mean, listen, he's shot 61 around Royal Portrush
as a teenager,
15 years of age, so it's, you know, on paper it's not a penalty kick, but that would be the one that he would love to win. But the thing that worries me is this: is he setting a precedent? Is this the way he's slowly going to slip away?
Okay.
You know, that's what worries me.
Let's hear a little bit about what he said separately about the Open and the prospect of winning it at what is his home course.
You know, everyone will talk up this year and every year about me trying to win the Masters, but if I could pick one tournament to win this year, it would be Portrush. I would definitely leave Augusta on the back burner and say, if I could win at Portrush, win the Open Championship, lift the claret jug there, that would be... I'm trying not to think about it because I think I would get overexcited. But it's a... I never thought I'd play a major at home in Northern Ireland. So, yeah, I think it would be the biggest achievement of my career if I were able to do that.
It's fairly... Like, you can't...
Yeah, I don't believe it, though. I mean...
Do you not?
No. Well, if he wins in Augusta, he wins the Grand Slam. End of story. That's bigger than... Winning the Grand Slam is bigger than winning the Open Championship in Royal Portrush, in my opinion.
But do you think, in his opinion, the prospect of winning it at the course where he basically fell in love with the game eclipses that for him? Realistically, will he ever play another Open at Portrush?
Oh, I would say so, yeah.
But significantly down the line.
If it's... If it doesn't clash for the Irish Open, maybe.
No, but
He's 29 now, so, you know, in the next dozen years, it'll definitely come back to Portrush, so... Will he be at the top of the game then? Nobody knows. But you cannot deny the fact that if he wins at Augusta National in less than 2 months' time, he's making history. He's one of only, five other people that have won the Grand Slam. So they're both huge in their own right. Maybe he's trying to deflect a little bit away from Augusta. I'm just really happy. If Rory's out there playing well, doing his thing, I'm happy to watch him because... I was fortunate enough to spend time with him when he came out on tour. I still really like the guy. I think he's a phenomenal golf game. He's by far the best player in the world if he's in the right space to do what he wants to do. Possibly this is what he's trying to do to get back there. Time will tell whether he's making the right decision or not.
So we look at the calendar. You've got a prize fund of $7 million for the Irish Open. You've a prize fund of $7 million for the Scottish Open, which takes place the following week. Is the biggest challenge for the Irish Open its place in the schedule? How many guys do you envisage will come to Ireland and spend a week in Lahinch, take Scotland off then as a prep for the Open?
There's two ways of looking at it. I would, if I was managing these top players, I would say you'd be better off playing Dubai Duty Free, Irish Open, Lahinch. Get used to links. You can hang out in Ireland for a week and put into practice what you found out that given week and then go up to Portrush and play your Open Championship. You could also go to not play an Irish Open and go to the Scottish Open the week beforehand, get caught up in a hoolie for 4 days at the Scottish Open and your swing can be all over the place, and then you have to get to Portrush Monday, Tuesday, try fix it and then get into major championship mindset. So there's different ways of looking at it. I would rather, if I were a top player approaching trying to get the most out of my game for the Open Championship, I would play at an Irish Open and have that week off in between, hang out down the west of Ireland or wherever and add to your prep and then cruise up to...
Okay. Do you have thoughts on this, Bernard?
I just wondered how difficult it is to go 3 weeks in a row.
It's simple.
Yeah.
It's simple.
So, you know what I mean? So that happens.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But obviously he has looked at where his success has come in the majors before, and he obviously is of the opinion that for him he can't do 3 weeks in a row.
I know what Retief Houston won in Slaley Hall in horrible weather up in the northeast of England, and they went over and won the US Open. Like, there's no exact science to this. They haven't worked it out yet.
No, but if his personal opinion is I can't do 3 weeks and this is what I need to do. And, you know, he could go in the majors this year and shoot the lights out and be proven completely right. So if that's his honestly held opinion of what helps him for the majors...
That's what he thinks at the moment. It all changes. He's going to play 7 events prepping for the Masters this year. He played 10 a couple of years ago. They're all trying to work this out. Mm. This is why golf is such an incredibly difficult game, because you cannot set yourself up to go, right, this is the week that I have it. They're all... As much as they're prepped, they have their team around them trying to narrow it down. You're still on the hoof a lot with golf. And a lot they follow one another like sheep as well. If one guy is doing it and it works, then they look at, well, like Brooks Koepka wins the US Open the last 2 years. He doesn't have a tournament in between the Open. So he's a month off after winning the US Open. Then he goes to the Open Championship, doesn't perform. You can guarantee he'll have an event this year. But there's no exact science to it. Porrick used to say, I can't, you know, play more than 3 in a row. And then one season he won his 4th event in a row. So, And I was kind of slagging him, you know, what happened to that? I can only play three in a row. So they're still trying to work this out. This season, in Rory's mindset, where he's at is he doesn't want to play three in a row. And that's fine if he thinks that's where it's at. But I just think some of these guys don't play enough golf.
Okay. And the reality is he can't win. Whatever he does, he's criticised. So the proof will be in the pudding.
Yeah, this is absolutely. And he's not afraid to... I think he's... Well, what's obvious is he's not afraid to actually make the hard decision and risk public backlash.
Which is great.
Yeah, it is good. You know, if that's what he believes is the best prep, well then, you know, you have to trust him on that, but it is obviously a disappointment for the Irish Open.
Is McIlroy's move today not going to undo all the good work he did for the Irish Open absolutely. Over the last few years and set the event backwards?
Listen, he's given millions to charity on this island through his foundation. Absolutely not for one second. He completely revived the Irish Open. He won €666,000 in the K Club and gave it away to local charities, so not for a millisecond. I'm completely judging him as a professional golfer.
McIlroy's problems isn't that he can't do it 3 weeks in a row, it's that of late he can't do it on a Sunday when he's in contention.
Yes, he's got to get back to winning ways. There's no denying that, but nobody knows that more than him, and no one is keener than him to do that either.
It's hard on Paul McGinley, who will host the event this year, and presumably if you're Paul, do you come out and address this and try and get it put to bed in terms of not letting it overshadow everything that will be spoken of in advance of the event?
It is hard on Paul. It's certainly not anything personal towards Paul, and Paul will understand that. I have no doubt that they will put on a phenomenal Irish Open in Lahinch. There's a huge amount of work that's gone on in the background already. Paul is in Mexico this week working for Sky. He'll be all over the players trying to get guys to come. And I've no doubt that we'll get a good field, but it's it's still a tournament that you have to go see. I mean, Lahinch is one of the most famous golf courses in this country. The atmosphere will be phenomenal. It'll be a carnival atmosphere down there. I used to go down there as a kid for the South of Ireland. It's a brilliant place. And just because Rory is playing is absolutely no reason not to go down and see loads of other world stars.
Okay, well, we'll wait and see how it plays out. So come here, we'll wish him well, and he's made a rod for his back if it doesn't go well for him, but he's big enough and old enough to realise that's the case.
Absolutely. I mean, you got to go with your convictions on this.
Okay, brilliant. We're going to chat rugby. We're going to take a quick break and Bernard's views ahead of the weekend to come stay with us.
Game on 2FM. Weekdays from 7.
And you're very welcome back to the programme. This is Damien O'Mara in for Hugh Cahill. 3-0 now to Arsenal. 3-1 up in aggregate against Badej Borisov. 71 minutes played. Valencia have taken the lead at home to Celtic. 1-0 they lead. 3-0 on aggregate there. So Celtic's European race looks like it is run. We're going to chat rugby. Round 3 of this year's Guinness Six Nations takes place this weekend. There's coverage of the Ireland-Italy game here on 2FM on Sunday afternoon. Gary Moran in the presenter's chair. Bernard Jackman, whoever he is, will be alongside Stephen Ferris in studio with Donal Lenihan and Michael Corcoran on commentary duty. Very briefly, the Ireland team will be named tomorrow. How many selection dilemmas are there for Joe Schmidt, considering the overriding thing is he needs to still get game time into players like Jonathan Sexton and Conor Murray? So is it very hard to see there being wholesale changes?
Yeah, I don't think there will. I think maybe 4 or 5. I think I'd like to see a change of hooker. Give Cronin a start, Kilcoyne a start. The fact that Ian Henderson got off the sighting, I think it's a great opportunity to get him into the game, and then potentially, you know, Carberry to play at 10 just to look after Sexton a little bit, and Robbie Henshaw maybe come back into the centre.
It's hard to see Joey start at out half, isn't it, considering Johnny Sexton only got limited game time against Scotland and by everyone's admission was off the boil against England. So was it 103 minutes he's played since the Munster game?
Yeah, so unfortunately he had so little game time. He had an injury in January, which does make the argument that you let him play. But I think Johnny's number one, and I think Carby did well, you know, against Scotland. And for him to start a test match, and it's not just starting a test match, it's actually, you know, running the show all week is a huge thing. I think that's where he didn't run the show against Scotland because Johnny was starting. I just think, you know, we're going to need Joey Carberry, and we're going to need him to be able to come in on a Monday morning and actually be like the quarterback and actually run the team that week at some stage. You know, more than likely if Johnny picks up an injury, and that could be a key match in a World Cup. So I just think this is a great opportunity to give him game time from the start, and, you know, have Johnny on the bench to get, you know, 30 minutes if he needs it.
But would France not be an even better opportunity to do that
for Joey?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's no. I don't. I think France, we got to play our best team.
Jeez, I'm very sorry.
No, it's okay. But
if looks could kill. Okay, so much more on that tomorrow night. France, Scotland. The France team named so early in the week. It feels like it happened weeks ago. Scotland today. Finn Russell, Stuart Hogg, Hugh Jones, Ryan Wilson, all out. Considering where France are at, would you still expect them to win? Or
I think France will. I think France will get a win. I think. Their backs to the wall. At least Brunel's picked guys in the right position this week, which gives them a chance. Now, they are very young. You know what I mean? Dupont at 9, Intermac at 10, and Ramos at fullback. Haven't got a huge amount of experience, but I thought Scotland were very poor against Ireland. Their handling was poor. The fact, you know, they've had those injuries now. And I think this could be the one game, or there'll probably be Italy as well. I think this is probably the one of two wins that France will get.
Okay. The big game of the weekend, no doubting, is the meeting of Wales and England. And there's been so much spoken around this. 4:45 kickoff on Saturday. England making the somewhat unusual decision to travel up to Cardiff on the day of the game from their base. We'll hear Warren Gatland's opinions on traffic in just a moment, but in advance, Eddie Jones, who isn't slow about bigging up his opponents this weekend.
It's a great opportunity for us to play against the Welsh side that's expected to win. You know, they've won 11 games in a row, so they can create a Welsh record. Their most famous coach is coaching his last game against England, so it's a great chance for us to go down there and spoil the party.
I think England making a significant mistake by travelling tomorrow. You know, coming through Newport at about 5 o'clock is probably not the best thing to be doing. Going through the Brynglass tunnels, I mean, you know, there's a good chance it could be tractors and buses and that there sort of holding them up. So, you know, that's going to be an experience for them.
So Mind Games 101 from Eddie Jones, and then what effectively was a call to arms to the farming community in Wales to get out. How bad is this tunnel?
Oh, well, listen, it does get blocked up, in fairness. They lifted the toll bridge. There's no toll anymore between Bristol and Newport, so it does get blocked up on a Friday evening at 5 o'clock. There's plenty of farmers as well in that area if they listen to Warren. But listen, you'd imagine Eddie Jones is not going to get stuck in that tunnel. I mean, their captain's run will be over at 11:30. They'll be on the bus. They'll be in their hotel in Cardiff by 3 or 4 o'clock. It's just funny. I mean, they're actually great friends, Warren and Eddie. And you know, England trained against Wales last year, which everyone was shocked by. But you know, they get on well. They're both, you know, good characters, and they're just having a bit of fun. I mean, Warren's been really quiet all week. He hasn't said a word, but until today. But Eddie Jones is just—he did the same thing coming to Dublin, saying, "Oh, you know, it's such a privilege to come and play the second best team in the world." Blah 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 blah. And in fairness, Wales are on an unbelievable run in terms of consecutive wins, but I don't think anybody in Wales is getting carried away thinking they're the best Welsh team ever. Mm. I mean, in actual fact, some of their performances have been, you know, probably mediocre, but they're being very good at grinding out wins. So England are hot favourites for this game, I think, and you know, Eddie Jones knows that, but it's just funny.
It's brilliant. Like, it makes for brilliant pantomime in advance of it. To look at the teams as were named today, how have Wales not managed to solve not quite the problem at out half, but you know, Gatland's gone into a World Cup year, and you can't cement your case that there's a standout number 10.
Now, bigger has been as 10, kind of.
Is that out of necessity? Out of you know, is
well,
it...
I think that's up for debate now, because obviously Bigger made the decision to leave Wales to go play in Northampton, and in fairness to Anscombe, he's been excellent for the Cardiff Blues, but his goal kicking has been poor, and that's been exposed without Lee Halfpenny. Mm. I think you know Anscombe is probably better at getting the back line going, but his goal kicking under extreme pressure hasn't been at the level probably required for an international 10. Now, Lee Halfpenny would obviously take away that pressure if he was fit, but he's still come back from concussion. I think this is a huge game for Anscombe. I think, you know, I think Eddie Jones would prefer that Anscombe was playing to Bigger, and I don't think I think Gatland's done this with a little bit of a view to the World Cup and given Anscombe a big opportunity. Maybe he feels the kicking game won't work against England. They got to try and take risks, but it is, you know, Reece Patchell will be in the mix as well, except he's obviously down with cushion as well. So, you know, it is unclear. Like, obviously we have Johnny Sexton number one, Scotland have Finn Russell. Wales aren't 100% sure who their best 10 is, but this, you know, if Anscombe had a stormer, well, then he'd obviously probably jump ahead of Bigger. Mm. But I think it's still up for grabs.
Having seen England now twice,
where is there even, you know, a glint of a weakness in them that Wales might be able to expose?
Well, we haven't seen it yet. No one has. Well, no, but that doesn't mean it's not there.
Yeah.
Just by nature, France didn't really. If anyone else had played him the week after Ireland, we would have known more, because they would have actually saw something in the Ireland game and actually targeted it. France didn't do their homework, didn't adapt their game plan, or didn't have a game plan to try and target it. So it was a wasted opportunity. We might as well say that England have only played one game in terms of what you can actually learn tactically. Warren will, you know, he'd have done his homework, and potentially they'll have spotted something. But England, based on what we've seen so far and based on what we've seen from Wales, I think England deserves to be favourites. And, you know, it's hard to see where Wales would be able to get an advantage over them. Obviously, you've got people like George North, who can make things happen out of nothing. You know, Jonathan Davies at 13 is outstanding, but I just don't see how they're going to have enough ball to really challenge him.
But how flattered have England been then by the two results so far? Because let's be very honest, Ireland just didn't show up on the opening weekend, and France were a basket case on the second.
Yeah, no, I agree. It is hard to actually judge, you know, how good they are. But in fairness against Ireland, they didn't really let us play. They looked very powerful. And, you know, they've lost Mako Vunipola, who's been outstanding for them. But they still have, you know, Tuilagi, who's apparently just signed for Racing Metro. You know, Billy Vunipola. Their back row looks great. Mark Wilson and Tom Curry. You know, they lost Itoje. They have Courtney Laws. They just look to be fit, well organised, and, you know, playing with a lot of confidence.
Okay, so France to win, Ireland to win, England to win.
Yes.
Simple as. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Half two start on 2FM on Sunday for coverage of that game. We're going to switch to soccer. The Republic of Ireland's women's team have been drawn in Group I against Greece, Montenegro, Ukraine and Germany for the UEFA European Championship qualifying campaign. Germany ranks second in the world. They've won the World Cup on two occasions, 2003 and 2007. The 16-team tournament will be held in England in 2021. The qualifying games get underway in August. The group winners and the three best runners-up will join England in the final tournament. The other six runners-up will then go into the playoffs. Let's get some reaction from the Irish manager, Colin Bell. He's been chatting to Andrew O'Connor.
Now we know who we're up against. That was what we've been waiting for. We'll approach every game 100%. I think, you know, we're definitely able to compete with every nation that's in that group, and that will be the first. Hopefully everybody will... you know, you need a bit of luck as well in these kind of things. Luck in the respect that all the girls are able to remain fit and healthy, something that that didn't happen during the campaign. There's certain top players injured, so that's where a little bit of luck comes in, but again, things that you can't really influence, but we're looking forward to getting going for sure.
Colin, most of us know obviously that Germany are at least the second best team in the world and have been right up there for a number of years. How good are the second seeds Ukraine?
I think there'll be a tough team to break down. Over the last few years in the women's game, developed definitely one or two outstanding players, and there'll be a tough unit, very aggressive. You know, they're second seeds. So today really has started now the preparation for us. Games, you know, I contacted then our video analyst that we're getting all the material together that we can basically start straight away in analysing all the teams.
That's Colin Bell with Andrew O'Connor. We've racing to come after the break.
Game on 2FM.
With Gillette, new SkinGuard Sensitive Razor. The first razor of its kind designed to stop irritation on sensitive skin. Gillette, the best a man can get.
And you're very welcome back to the programme. So we've Cheltenham quickly approaching on the horizon. Plenty of build-up to come on that between now and then. And a great documentary tonight, if you're into your racing, to watch this evening, focusing on the increased number of women making a name for themselves as jockeys. Jump Girls, which was made by the team who produced the highly regarded Jump Boys, airs at 9:30 on TG Cahir tonight.
Depending on where you're riding out, usually you're up between 6 and 7. You're going, you're riding out. You could be riding at one place, you could be then going to ride work for someone else, and you could be going racing. You know, you're definitely kept busy anyway.
I suppose everyone's a danger. When you come to Cheltenham, it's so competitive. It's all about kind of getting into a rhythm and trying to hold on to everything you can, because it's a long way up the home straight and you're climbing a hill as well.
She's getting rides from Willie, from Gordon, from all the main trainers now. She's clearly one of the well-established leading jockeys in Ireland.
No, I haven't actually watched the Gold Cup at all. I never watched it. I'm very good at sort of just forgetting something, you know, you just put it in a box and don't get it out again.
Jessie is the only woman in the upper echelons of training. Women are stronger people than men mentally. And men are slick a bit. And women don't. The real strong women say, go f*** yourself.
So there you have it. That's a clip from Junk Girls, which airs on TG Carhart later on this evening. I'm delighted to say I'm joined in studio by the programme's director, Luke McManus, and also jockey Katie O'Farrell. You're very welcome to the programme. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Katie, we'll come to yourself and how you've ended up in this line of life. Well, I suppose it's a graduation of life into profession more than anything else in just a moment. But Luke, a lot of people, the previous documentary when it came out made such an impact on people and the stark reality for a lot of people of what life at the top end was like as a jockey. Was it always inevitable that there was going to be a follow-up, or was there always inevitable that there was going to be a follow-up which focused on female jockeys?
Well, to be fair, I think TG Cahir were always keen to do Jump Girls as a sequel to Jump Boys, and myself and the producers, Dennis Kerwin and Stephen Cullinan, were sort of maybe needed to be convinced a little bit, you know, because at that time there really was just two amateur riders, Nina Carberry and Katie Walsh, and obviously Jessica Harrington was well established. But then as the years went by, professionals started to emerge. You had Rachel Blackmore, you had Katie O'Farrell, who's with us today, turning pro, and then over in the UK you had Lizzie Kelly and Bryony Frost emerging as kind of major riders as well. And Jessica had an unbelievable season then, 2017, so it sort of felt right, this is the right time to go for it. So, and it was great to do it because a lot of stuff has happened, not just in racing but around women's sport generally. You know, so many big Irish characters like your Kelly Harrington and Katie Taylor and you know, the ladies football finals getting so many people attending and breaking records. So, you know, we've done a little bit of work with 20 by 20, you know, on our documentary, just because it feels to me that the momentum is behind women's sport across the board now. But what was interesting about racing was, you know, we started off making a film about racing, women and racing, but it very quickly just became a film about jockeys and trainers because the women don't want to dwell on the fact that they're women. You know, it's not really an issue for them, you know.
Well, Katie, we'll get straight into that. This is a documentary which is about jockeys who happen to be female rather than female jockeys. Is that a fair way of describing it? I know that sounds somewhat complicated, but like, does it drive you demented to be described as a female jockey rather than just a jockey?
Yeah, for sure. Like, I think it is a big thing. We're just jockeys. We're just out there doing our job like any of the rest of them. And for us, we don't see it that way. Like, we're just in there doing our job and doing what we love to do. We don't see that, you know, segregation or like difference between us that other people might. But I do think it's changing, and it's changing, it's evolving all the time, which is great.
How difficult is it then? Like are you constantly being asked, how can a girl do this, how can a woman do this compared to the men, when in reality, like, this and modern pentathlon are the two sports where men and women compete side by side, and, you know, racing has probably been the leader in terms of active male versus female participation.
Yeah, like, there's nothing like getting out there and just showing it, like, showing you can do what they can do and you know, go out and beat them at the game. But definitely, it's probably the difficulty comes from trying to get the opportunities to show that, to show what you can do and what you have to offer and, you know, where your ability lies among the rest of them. You know, it's just getting the chances to do that is the difficult thing.
And it's just about seizing those opportunities then, you know, getting rides and then maximising it.
Yeah, I suppose for me, it's like a constant trying to just improve myself and my, you know, my strength or my fitness or whatever it is, so that if and when the opportunities arise, you know, you're ready for them and you make good of them.
Mm. Luke, is it a difficult sell to approach athletes like this and try and say to female athletes, we're making a documentary purely about female sport? Because in the past, an awful lot of media coverage and a lot of people, and maybe ourselves included in here, have been guilty of somewhat patronizing level of coverage, or that it's coverage for coverage's sake rather than for merit's sake.
Well, I'll tell you, if you want to try and patronize Jessica Harrington and Katie Walsh, good luck to you,
brave man.
You know, I think there was a little bit of reluctance maybe, but on the part of the participants. But I think the Jump Boys experience, and we did one about Arkell the great steeplechaser from the 60s, and we did one about Galway races for TG Cars. So we do have that kind of track record, and I think among racing people it's a tight enough community, and they kind of go, right, these guys are okay, they're truth tellers about the sport, you know, and they've done it in the past. So there was an element of trust there. It's interesting what Katie was saying, though. I think one thing Rachel Blackmore said to us was that Nina Carberry and Katie Walsh, they kind of proved that women could do it. You know, like, they were the ones, like, if you look at Nina's record at Cheltenham, you know, the number of winners, I think she had seven festival winners.
Seven, I think.
You know, like, if you look at what Katie Walsh achieved, you know, they both won the Irish Grand National. Katie came so close to winning the English Grand National. You know, they were able to do it. They were unbelievable talented riders. So I think that idea of, oh, you know, girls can't ride horses, they pretty much put pay to that.
Katie, what's the support structure like within racing? Because to look at it from the outside in, there's so much at stake for the individual jockeys that our natural presumption would be that there's going to be egos and tension and I want to beat you and I'm not going to give you a dig out. But it's the opposite, really, isn't it? It is like a band of brothers and sisters.
It is, to be fair. I think we all know how difficult it is. So, the you know, and how changeable it can be, you know, from good times to bad. And I don't think among ourselves, although we're competitors and we're against each other, we're not trying to make it any harder for each other than it already is. So, yeah, there is definitely a sense of camaraderie in the weigh room. And
was it always inevitable that you'd end up in racing, considering your background?
Possibly.
Did you ever have ambitions to do anything else?
Well, I did go to college and study to be a teacher, which would have been a much more pleasant route, I suppose.
Some would debate that, considering what teachers have
To be honest, I think I was in I went to college, my mum drilled it into me from, you know, an early age that you've got to be educated and this, that and the other. So I did it not against my will, but I didn't really have any, I didn't know what I wanted to do or be. There was nothing in college. I knew a month in, I was like, this is not for me, but I'm not going to drop out to do nothing. I want to have an education, and at least I could play around with the idea of being a teacher down the line maybe. So when I finished and got my degree, I just went straight into horses from there. I went to work in Ballydoyle for Aidan O'Brien for 2 years, and it was during that time I rode as an amateur and improved and was riding in a lot of professional races as an amateur. So that's kind of what instigated the move for me, the change.
And did you personally experience much opposition or much questioning of, you know, why don't you go off and do something else with your life rather than try and bring this upon yourself? I don't mean to be patronising in asking that, but that's that is something that female jockeys have had to deal with in the past.
Yeah, like, yeah and no. I think there's a bit of both. While there is a small want in my parents maybe or people that care about me for my safety, I suppose, just to maybe like, would it not be better now, and like, you know, if I'm sporting a little black eye at the minute or I was on crutches or whatever, there would be people just out of concern and care for you that they would want you to do something that you're not so much at risk. But at the same time, the support I get and the support network of people all around me is huge, and you know, you can't do it without that.
But you've had the same story as every other jockey. You've come back from like very serious injury. You've ridden with, like, true to say, you rode with a broken leg without realizing you'd broken it.
Yeah.
That's inconceivable.
When people say it out loud, I'm like, yeah, that even sounds stupid. What was I doing?
I have a paper cut that I've got a week's sympathy out of at home. Genuinely.
Sometimes they're the worst, though.
Well, they are.
Sometimes
you tell
my back's really sore right now, by the way. It's really sore.
You are a different breed. Jockeys.
Well, people say stuff like that, but I think it's sort of a passion. Like, I love what I do, and these are the things that are involved in doing it. So
I wouldn't be here with a broken leg.
But you had a huge win at Galway, and that adrenaline and that excitement and that momentum.
Yeah, I mean, I think in five minutes of glory like that in Galway, it condenses all of the hard work and makes it so worthwhile. Like,
that's Katie Wisherwell, great documentary on tonight. If you want to hear an extended version of that interview, you can access the Game On podcast, which is also available on SoundCloud. So every programme, every evening, broken up into chunks, and you can listen to that. They are a different breed. I don't, like, jockeys are crazy.
They are. They're the probably the bravest sports people, I would say.
100%.
Yeah, after and it is golfers, important that as with a lo- sorry
after golfers, of course.
Yeah, well, yeah. As I said before, as a man who makes his living by speaking to people in a padded room in the notional belief that people are listening, you're a man who chases a tiny white ball around.
Yes.
Yeah.
With a drone to help me.
Yeah, there you go. Right, we're going to chat. US Sports Shep is with us. How are you?
I'm doing just fine, sir. How are things over in on your side of the pond?
We're alive. We're well. We're, you know, enjoying life and realizing how lucky we are to have it the way we have it. I want to talk to you in a minute about the Hulk Hogan biopic, which I'm already looking forward to. Chris Hemsworth is going to play Hulk Hogan.
Heard that today, yeah.
Hulk is going to be the executive producer, so you can be damn sure the tape from a couple of years ago is not going to feature in the film. But that's a different story for.
Well, yeah, who's going to play Bubba the Love Sponge? You know,
that was the best part about that Hulk Hogan scandal. Was it involved a man whose name is Bubba the Love Sponge? Anyway, on from that, here's a segue of all segues. To get very serious for a moment, Colin Kaepernick, which is a story we have talked about on so many occasions in the past, finally has reached some level of, well, probably not personal settlement with the NFL, but financial settlement. The rumored figure is he's been paid off and got $60 million for his trouble and the hardship and the persecution that he has suffered at the hands of American football in recent years.
Yeah, I mean, you see different reports of numbers, and you know, it's a quote unquote confidential settlement, so it's kind of hard to, you know, what to trust. But I mean, you know, as you mentioned, we've spoken about this quite a bit on this show in the last couple of years, and I mean, this is really just kind of almost like at the intersection of what's been going on. I know it's been going on around the world, but specifically in America, you know, with politics, justice, sports, social media. It's just a lot of different things that are all involved in this story. And, you know, to try to say, oh, well, I've got a handle on it. It's kind of almost like it's just an ongoing story. I don't necessarily think that this really it doesn't solve anything. I mean, it solves something related to Colin Kaepernick, but all of the issues that he has been trying to address, I mean, you know, they're still going to be there tomorrow morning. I mean, they're still there today. So, you know, I do think he raised consciousness. He raised the conversations that needed to be had. Some good, some bad, you know, reactions, same way, some good, some bad. It's been a weird story to kind of chronicle and watch as the years gone by. And as you said, it's not a personal settlement, but it is definitely a financial one, at least.
I know there's no absolute truth in this or no general consensus in, you know, for all the people for whom he is a hero, there is a significant population for whom he is a villain. And one of the criticisms of him, which has raised its head again this year, is that, like, $60 million isn't a lot of money relative to what an NFL player can make. But the accusation that he has again cashed in with Nike this week by, you know, leveraging money out of his notoriety in some people's minds, is that an argument that holds a lot of water within American sport at the moment?
I personally don't think so, and here's why. I think if the NFL was willing to settle with him, it's because what was going to come out in a potential lawsuit or in a potential deposition. You know, they were asking for Colin Kaepernick and his lawyers were asking for phone records and email records between the league office and owners and different things like that. All of this related to I don't want to say his case or his name, you know, so it was probably, I would venture to say, in the NFL's best interest to not have, if that material is out there, to not have it come to light. You know, look, yes, an NFL player potentially has the ability to make a lot of money like this, but the average NFL career is like 3 years. Mm. And most players don't make anywhere remotely close to this type of money. And so he has donated a lot of the money that he's made in his career to various causes, even when he was not on a team, not on a roster, not getting a steady paycheck, he was still donating money. And so I think it would be really, you know, not accurate to say that he was doing this for some type of cash grab. I think he honestly believes in what he was fighting for.
Jeff, do you think he might possibly run for office in some shape or form in the future?
Yeah, I believe that could be coming, you know, potentially after he's done with his playing career. Look, I mean, there are teams that are now basically saying that they're interested in him. I mean, they, you know, everybody keeps saying, well, you know, the Patriots need a backup quarterback, and, you know, Tom Brady's not getting any younger, and the Panthers need a backup quarterback. Those are some of the teams that you see listed as, like, you know, potential sources where he could end up. So, I can't guarantee that he's going to be on a team this year. It would not surprise me at all if now that this is quote-unquote behind us, somebody's willing to extend an offer to him, which, and let's be honest, would be quite telling about whether or not there was collusion going on with in regards to him signing with the team.
Okay. Good week for Nike because the Icon jersey they've released with Kaepernick on it has sold out completely. Bad week for Nike. A guy, one of the rising stars of basketball, wears your boots and 33 seconds later suffers a major injury because the thing fell apart.
Yeah, so there's a player for Duke basketball, which is located in Durham, North Carolina, 8 miles away from the University of North Carolina. This is the biggest rivalry in college basketball. For listeners who do not know this, in American college basketball, this is it. And they were playing last night. President Obama was in the stands. There was rumors that LeBron James was going to show up, and so there's a player named Zion Williamson. He's considered to be the overwhelming favorite to be the number one draft pick this year for in the NBA draft. And 33 seconds into the game last night, he went to go make a move, and his left shoe basically ripped apart, and he injured his right leg. So, I mean, you've have a lot of different issues now all of a sudden coming together here where, you know, it's an amateur player. He gets hurt. You know, he could be potentially, you know, damaging his future. So you've got all these questions now about, you know, does he come back? What is he going to do moving forward? But yes, not really good publicity for Nike. When, you know, Michael Jordan is the most famous alumni North Carolina has ever put out, and he is obviously the face of Nike, and his biggest rival last night suffers this injury. There's just a lot going on here.
Yeah, it's probably a Michael Jordan paid sniper in the stands, but that's yet to be proven. just to finish, we were talking to Gary earlier, and you know, I mentioned the obscenity of money that exists in modern sport. The San Diego Padres, one of the most bizarre contract deals of recent times. Begging the question, just how much money is a sportsman, and particularly someone within baseball, worth? Give us a deal on their latest big 10-year signing.
Yeah, so they signed Manny Machado to a 10-year contract worth reportedly $300 million, which is the largest free agent contract in American sports history. But it probably won't be for more than another week or so, because Bryce Harper, who has played for the Washington Nationals for the last several years, is also a free agent. And he will command money, you know, on a similar scale. But Harper is several years younger than Machado. Harper's in his early 20s. Machado's in his mid-20s. And I know that's not old in the real world, but it's old in sports, or it's older in sports. And you have to wonder, what is the likelihood that he's going to last 10 years? I think there's an option to void the contract after 5, but that's still a tremendous amount of money. I mean, you're talking $30 million a year. You know, it seems like it was about 12 or 13 years ago, Alex Rodriguez signed that giant contract with the Yankees, and I don't believe he made it to the end of that. Mm. And so I don't know if we've hit the peak, but boy, this is just a lot of money. He plays third base and he hits a lot of home runs. He's going to need to do that in San Diego.
It's a lot of jerseys and bobbleheads to sell to make that back. Shep, thanks for joining us. As always, we're out of time. Good to talk to you. Thanks very much. Bernard, thank you very much. Enjoy the rugby over the weekend.
Thank you.
Gary, we'll try not to fall out over Rory McIlroy and his absence from the Irish Open. Conor Bean's on the way. Dan is here after 10. Thanks to Andrew DePuer, our broadcast coordinator. The programme produced by Ronan Lawler. From Damien, till we chat again, good night.
This is 2FM.